Lecture 12, Emptiness.
In the last couple of lectures, we've talked about the origin of the Mahayana. We've talked about the Bodhisattva ideal as something that ordinary people can practice in this life. And then we took an excursion into the heavens and talked about celestial Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and also talked about how the devotion to those celestial Buddhas and Bodhisattvas constituted a really important part of the Mahayana revolution in the Buddhist tradition. Now, obviously, we've seen that the Mahayana introduced a lot of important changes into the Buddhist tradition by adding these values to that complex tradition that we already now have studied in some detail. But no change was as profound or as far-reaching as the concept that we call emptiness. This is a concept that, in a negative way, challenged or undermined many of the rigid categories of traditional Buddhism. In lots of respects, it seems to pull the rug right out from under traditional Buddhist practice. But also in a more positive way, as we've become accustomed to seeing in the Buddhist tradition, all negative ideas seem to have their positive side. In a more positive way, the concept of emptiness introduced a spirit of affirmation and almost of infinite possibility that wasn't present in the earlier tradition, a spirit that we saw present to some degree in that vision of the cosmos that Suddhana had as he gazed on the body of the Bodhisattva Samantabhadra. So our challenge in this lecture is really to develop for ourselves a balanced understanding of this difficult Mahayana concept, the concept of emptiness. A balanced understanding that will help us account for both its positive and its negative dimensions. I'd also have to say in passing that this is the concept that I've spent most of my adult life studying. This is really where I put my feet down most firmly in the study of the Mahayana. So I present this to you not just with a kind of theoretical interest, but something that sort of strikes me in the gut. The doctrine of emptiness, I think, in a lot of ways, is one of the most profound and challenging religious concepts in the world, and one that if you can grasp, if you can even just get a taste of, will help you see not just the basic categories of Buddhism, but also lots of other important categories in life in a radically different way. So let's start out with a basic analysis of this concept of emptiness. Emptiness can be understood, I think, as a radical extension of the concept of no-self in traditional Buddhism. This is a concept that we've already talked about. And let's lay it out for ourselves somewhat methodically. We asked ourselves now, as the lectures are moving slowly through the study of Buddhism, what concepts of the self have we already learned? Well, one, I suppose, would come from the Upanishads, that old Hindu idea of the eternal self that's identical to Brahman and identical to the one reality that underlies the unity, the diversity of this world. So in the Hindu tradition, the self is identical to Brahman and it is eternal and permanent. The Theravada tradition expresses a traditional Buddhist view that undermines this old Hindu vision of the permanent or eternal self. In traditional Buddhism, there is nothing permanent that endures from one moment to the next. So traditional Buddhists say that there is no self. There is no permanent identity that endures from one moment to the next. All that we see in reality is just a series of momentary phenomena bound together to give the illusion of some kind of continuity, like the flickers in the flame of a candle or the moments in the flow of a river. So the self, according to traditional Buddhism, was made up of a series of momentary phenomena known as dhammas in Pali or as dharmas in Sanskrit. This is a use of the word dharma that we haven't talked about before. It's dharma as fundamental constituent of reality. So the self in traditional Buddhism is simply a flow of momentary phenomena called dharmas. Now, the Mahayana took a step further. They went beyond this traditional Buddhist idea of the self to deny the reality, not just of an enduring self, but to deny the reality of the moments themselves. So they said that these momentary phenomena, these dharmas that make up the flow of life like the flickers in a candle flame, are empty of identity, empty of reality. That's the way they express this insight. All dharmas are empty of reality. The word empty here is shunya. And from this comes the doctrine of emptiness. What is the nature of all things? It is their emptiness. The fact that even as momentary phenomena, they have nothing that you can hold on to that gives them any kind of identity. Now, by rejecting the idea that the personality or the flow of existence is made up of real moments, the Mahayana completely reoriented and changed the conceptual system of Buddhism. Now, this may come to you as a rarefied and rather abstract concept. So let me see if I can give you a tag that you can hold on to compare the doctrine of emptiness with the stuff that we've talked about before. You know, you could say that traditional Buddhism adopts a view that is a little bit like Heraclitus's view of all of reality being made up of simply a flow of phenomena. Heraclitus said you can't step into the same river twice because the river is constantly flowing. Well, what does the Mahayana say? Not just that you can't step into the same river twice, they say that you can't step into the same river once. Because in reality, there is no identity in the momentary flow of the river. You can't step into the same river once. That's the doctrine of emptiness in the Mahayana. Now that, I think, is pretty abstract concept and pretty puzzling, I suspect, when you come to it for the first time. So it's important for us to reflect, I think, on the consequences of the doctrine to try to get some understanding of how it worked out in the larger scheme of the Mahayana tradition. So let me, if I can, just draw out some of the implications of this basic Mahayana concept. First of all, the doctrine of emptiness results in a concept of non-duality. If everything is empty of any real identity, then there can't be any real difference between any two things. And as a result, Mahayana texts often equate emptiness with a doctrine of non-duality. What does this mean? If everything is empty, then there can't be any difference or duality between nirvana and samsara. And there can't be any difference between us and the Buddha. What that means, it's interesting to think about here, what that means is that nirvana is right here at this moment, right now, if we can only understand it correctly. And it also means that we are already Buddhas if we understand the nature of ourselves as being no different from the nature of the Buddha. Now, this is a pretty significant reorientation of the ideals of traditional Buddhism. Traditional Buddhism, sure, there was no permanent reality in anything. Everything was in a process of flow, but there was no way of confusing nirvana, which was out there at the end of this process of evolution from the samsara that began it. Now this distinction is stripped away. Nirvana is right here, right in the midst of that flow, if we can begin to perceive it correctly. So one of the important consequences of emptiness is this doctrine of non-duality. A second important consequence has to do with the practice of the bodhisattva. We've said before that the bodhisattva returns in this world, comes back in samsara, comes back from the pursuit of nirvana for largely altruistic reasons, in order to help other people pursue the path to nirvana. Now, that's still true. Bodhisattva has compassion for others. That's the basic motivation of the Mahayana tradition. But you can see here now, when you confront the doctrine of emptiness, that a bodhisattva doesn't come back just for altruistic purposes. It's not just altruism that drives the bodhisattva back into this world. Why? There isn't any difference between nirvana and samsara. And if there's no nirvana out there to seek that's different than what's going on in this world, you can only find it here. You gotta come back. There's no place that you can escape from where we are right now. So the bodhisattva, sure, is back in the world of samsara to help other people, but the bodhisattva is also back here for reasons that have to do with the bodhisattva's own awareness, the bodhisattva's own sense of himself or herself, to know nirvana right here in the experience of suffering in this world. Now, another point about emptiness that's important to grasp, especially if you want to move into something that involves a more technical understanding of the concept, is to see emptiness as connected to a doctrine of what we call two truths. There are two separate perspectives that you can take on any ordinary aspect of our experience. From a conventional point of view, from the point of view of ordinary experience, you have to take it seriously. You know, you wake up in the morning, you got a job to do, you need to bring a paycheck in at the end of the week, you got people whose lives make a demand on you, brothers, sisters, mother, children, they've all got questions that you got to do something to try to solve. And no matter how much you try to separate yourself from all of those issues, they are there, man. And if you step away from them, you're going to bear all sorts of consequences that are going to be painful to you. That's conventional reality. That's ordinary reality as we face it in our ordinary experience. But ultimately, according to the doctrine of emptiness, that does not exist. It just isn't there. It has no identity. Mother, who's she? Brother, who is he? This place that we're sitting in, this classroom, what's that? Where are we? There's nothing here. Who am I speaking? Whoa, I'm not here. That's all an illusion. It's empty. There's nothing here for us to talk about. These are the two truths. Conventional truth gets us in the gut. It's real in terms of our ordinary experience. Ultimately, what is that? Nothing. It's empty. It's not there. Now, a true understanding of emptiness holds both of these two together simultaneously. This is well worth thinking about. This is a pretty good thought experiment that pretty soon becomes a life experiment. To hold both of these two things together simultaneously, to take seriously all the conventional issues that we got to deal with in the world and realize at the same time, it isn't there. It's not there. You see this really clearly in a lot of the terminology of the Mahayana tradition. Someone was asking me a little bit earlier about how a bodhisattva has compassion for other people if there is no self. Question like that. How do you have compassion for other people if there is no self? In the Mahayana tradition, you have that kind of compassion by walking right straight into this paradox, right through the door into this paradoxical world. The text says, "May I achieve salvation, may I achieve awakening for the sake of all other beings, and may I understand that there is no awakening to achieve, no other being for me to have compassion on, and I myself don't exist." Both of those two things simultaneously are necessary to be able to work out the bodhisattva ideal. So that's the doctrine of two truths. It's one of the ways of speaking in a technical sense about the concept of emptiness. Now, another thing that you can say about it is that the relationship between these two truths is not a static thing. It's not that you kind of got conventional truth over here on this side of the room, and you got ultimate truth over here on this side, and you kind of bend down, you take a little bit of ultimate truth for a while, and then you go over and you take some conventional truth and try to find some kind of a balance between them. The truth is, you've actually got something that's more like a process of thought and a process of life, where you move from the conventional to the ultimate and back to the conventional again, in a way that brings a taste of one and mixes it with a taste of the other. Now, you often see this in a technical way in Mahayana writings, where the Bodhisattva begins by affirming the distinction between things, thinking, here I am in samsara, here I am, and I'd really like to get to nirvana, and let me see what I can do to try to get there. Start out with some sense of distinction. And then, as you study emptiness, you realize that there's no difference between samsara and nirvana is no longer any kind of a goal that you have to reach that's different from where you are. That's all well and good. But then you have to ask yourself whether there's any difference, I hope you can stay with me on this one, whether there's any difference between that second stage of thinking and the first, right? The first stage is a stage in which you distinguish between nirvana and samsara. The second stage, you don't distinguish between nirvana and samsara. Well, what about the distinction between these two stages? Is that distinction real, or isn't it? When you ask that question for yourself, what happens is that you come back into the first stage. There is no distinction between the... I hope this doesn't sound too confusing. There is no distinction between the stage of no distinction and the stage of distinction, which means that you've got to hold the distinctions and the no distinctions together in the same awareness of the world. Now this, sorry, I'm presenting it to you in a way that sounds absurdly abstract, but let me, if I can, distill it into a couple of aphorisms and into a typical experience of the understanding of emptiness. First of all, an aphorism. It's often said in the Zen tradition when people study the tea ceremony, and they learn to handle a bowl and to handle tea in a certain carefully prescribed way that's meant to express a certain understanding of experience and to bring real, in a ritual way, the experience of emptiness. So they say, at the beginning, for an ordinary person, you and me, a bowl is a bowl and tea is tea. We can agree on that. A bowl is a bowl and tea is tea. But when you start to study Zen, a bowl is no longer a bowl, and tea is no longer tea, as you come to understand the emptiness of each of these entities, and for that matter, the emptiness of any category in ordinary experience. But then when you are awakened, when you close the circle, when you come back into the conventional awareness of things, a bowl is a bowl, and tea is tea. So the process of meditation that's involved in this tea ceremony is meant to take you from ordinary experience into an experience of emptiness and then to bring you back to experience in this life so that will make it possible for you to be fully present to each moment in and of itself. This closes the circle between the two truths. Let me give you another example of this. I won't claim that any of these is going to completely express what I'm trying to get at here. But let me give you another example. When I was teaching in Harvard a few years ago, we had a visit from the Dalai Lama, who is one of the great exponents of the doctrine of emptiness, in addition to being a great bodhisattva. And he billed his talk as an explanation of the Buddhist doctrine of self. He was going to tell us what we were. And tell us about ourselves. And I'd say about 500 people showed up in Sanders Theater at Harvard to hear all of this. Sanders Theater is an old theater. It's a wonderful place and holds lots of people who wanted to hear the Dalai Lama tell them something about themselves. I gave an introduction to him, explained that he was coming to do such and such, and told him how happy we were to hear him. And then I sat down and joined the audience and listened to him expound selfhood in the Buddhist tradition. We started out with a conventional view of self. He said, all you out there, you want to know what it means to be aware of yourself, to discover your own identity, you might say. Be compassionate to other people. Help them. Love them. That's the way you live out the Bodhisattva ideal. He did this in English, and it seemed very simple. And I would say, on one level, extremely convincing. You want to know yourself? Be kind to others. Know your identity in that way. It's a classic expression of the Bodhisattva ideal. And it's based on an assumption of difference. I am who I am. I'd like to know who I am perhaps a little bit better. And there is my neighbor over there, and let me try to help him in some way. Let me try to remove that person's suffering. And then he said, you know, in that kind of sly way that you do at the beginning of a talk like this, but, you know, this doctrine of self is a little more complicated than that in the Mahayana tradition, and I can't really explain it to you in English because I'm not all that good at it. So I'm going to shift to Tibetan, and I'm going to give you the 7 different reasons why there is no identity in anything. He may even have lowered his voice a little bit and said, well, I'm going to give you the 7 reasons why everything is empty of identity. He had a translator who was translating this for him in a fairly mechanical but a very impressive way, because it was a technical form of Tibetan that's not all that easy to translate. And he showed us the 7 different reasons why we did not exist as selves, and that neighbor whom we were attempting to help also did not exist as a self, and in fact, 7 different reasons why everything was empty of any kind of identity. There was no self in anything. And then he paused at the end of the lecture, getting a little close to the end. You know, we were expecting him to bring it to a conclusion, and he began to smile a little bit. And he said, well, you know, if there isn't any self, and there really isn't even any no self, there's nothing for us to talk about, who is it who told you all of this? Who told you this? Who delivered this lecture to you? And he smiled a little bit more. And he used a phrase in Tibetan that I still very vividly remember, duck tsam. Dak tsam. The translator translated it as mere I. Mere I. The Harvard Crimson reporter heard this and went back to the newspaper and wrote an article explaining that the Dalai Lama thought the personality was right here in the eye, right here in the eyeball. But obviously, I mean, if you think about this a bit, he wasn't talking about the I, E-Y-E. He was talking about the I, the letter I, the mere ego. And I think to capture the real drift of the real force of the Dalai Lama's words at that moment, you wouldn't want to use a technical phrase like mere I. You would want to say something like, just me. Who is it who's delivering this to you? Just the little old Dalai Lama. Just me. That's the spirit, I think, of this third stage. That's really where the doctrine of emptiness is trying to take you. It involves a wise, somewhat humorous, perhaps, appropriation of the categories of the conventional world, to speak again abstractly as we were speaking before, but to appropriate them with a sense of freedom and a sense of lightness. I've often talked in the Buddhist tradition about buoyancy, about lightness, and about freedom. Emptiness, in the end, is that kind of feeling. It's the appropriation of the categories of the conventional world with a sense of freedom, wisdom, buoyancy, humor, with a smile. Now, if that's true, what effect is it going to have on us in this world? A lot of people think that if everything is empty of any kind of identity, then there's no reason for us to take seriously anything that we do. In fact, they find it a very depressing idea. A lot of the stuff that they thought was so important to them no longer is significant anymore. This is that old negative fear that you seem popping up from time to time in the Buddhist tradition throughout all of its history. But if you can feel the doctrine of emptiness as I've been trying to express it to you here with the lightness of the Dalai Lama's smile, what you sense is not a feeling of negativity, a feeling of depression, a feeling that something important has been taken away from you. In fact, you feel some sort of a surge of infinite possibility. Often the doctrine of emptiness is expressed as power in the Mahayana tradition, not as disability, but a sense of being genuinely empowered. Because if nothing has any kind of identity in its own right, then there is really no barrier to accomplishing anything that you want to accomplish. And you can bring to bear in ordinary experience a sense of freedom and a sense of directness and a sense of empowerment that would be difficult if you were in fact caged in this world of frozen objects that are what they were and couldn't change. So the doctrine of emptiness is often expressed in the Mahayana tradition by saying, by a phrase that was provided to us by the philosopher Nagarjuna, everything is possible for someone for whom emptiness is possible. Accept emptiness and accept a spirit of infinite possibility. Now, if this is true, then, how would we express emptiness in the context of a Mahayana ritual? I've spoken about emptiness now as an abstract concept. I've tried to give you some stories that allow you to get the feeling in some way of how this concept works itself out in everyday experience. How is it ritualized in the Mahayana tradition? That is, how could we bring it into the concrete texture of Mahayana religious life? Well, one of the most interesting ways this is done in Mahayana devotion, in the practice of Mahayana worship, is through a process of visualization. Let me describe it to you as if we were doing it for ourselves here together. Say we want to worship a Buddha, something that you do in this tradition. You want to pay homage to Avalokiteshvara or pay homage to Amitabha. Now, to do that, of course, we could get on a plane, we could go to Japan, we could worship in one of the great temples of Amitabha, temples that we'll see pictures of or describe later on in our lectures when we come to Japanese Buddhism. And we could go to a flower market, we could buy some flowers, we could perhaps get some gold leaf to add to the Buddha's form, and we could go to the temple, make an offering of the flowers, and light some incense. That's worship. It'd be great. It would be meritorious. It would allow us to reflect on the compassion of Amitabha Buddha, and it would all push forward in some way our practice of the Mahayana tradition. But if everything is empty, why not do it now? Why go to Japan to do that? Let's imagine in front of ourselves at this moment, right here in front of us, a golden Buddha, his body glowing with golden rays. And out of each pore of the body come thousands of rays. And at the end of each one of those rays, there are other Buddhas that are glowing golden too. And there, out of their pores come even more rays, so that the whole world is full of Buddhas. And let's imagine that we go to a flower market somewhere, wherever it would be. Go down to the Boston Flower Market and let's gather up with thousands of arms all the flowers that are in that market. And let's bring them back here and place them in front of this golden Buddha and bow down to that Buddha and say, "Oh, I praise you, Amitabha Buddha, for all the compassion that you brought to people in this world. Lift us up with your compassion and take us to the pure land." My question would be, we've just done that. It's a nice little bit of Mahayana worship. Did we do anything? Was that a religious action? Did we praise the Buddha? The Mahayana answer to that would be, yeah, we did. We did that. In fact, we did it in pretty elaborate form, actually. We didn't praise just one Buddha. We praised millions of Buddhas. And we brought in millions of arms, flowers, to pay homage to that Buddha. But then, of course, the worship is done in a way that underlines for us at the same time that we didn't really, because there is no Buddha to worship, and there is no us to do the worship. So at the same time, we made an infinite store of merit and realized very concretely that all of that merit was empty. So the exercise itself, the ritual, becomes a way of offering to the Buddha the kind of offering that builds merit in the world in almost an infinitely expansive way, and also at the same time becomes a concrete realization of the understanding of emptiness. In that action, I think in a simple way, we step right into the heart of the Mahayana tradition.
We hope you've enjoyed these lectures from our Great Courses series. Our courses are now available to order online. Visit our website at www.teach12.com or call our customer service representatives at 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-TEACH-12. Thank you very much.